Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like geography, visual arts, the performing arts, and literature.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith. We're joined today by Ethan Moses. Ethan is a maker, designer, and fabricator specializing in some of the oldest forms of chemical photography. He utilizes state-of-the-art digital fabrication techniques like 3D printing and laser cutting to create cameras based on old designs and expired patents. He is a regular contributor to online magazines and blogs about chemical photography, such as Emulsive, Film Shooters Collective, and 35mm Collective. He teaches chemical photography techniques online and at makerspaces, and he is also a member of the board of directors of QLab, a makerspace in Albuquerque. His company, Cameradactyl, makes 3D printed film cameras and accessories for the general public.
Ethan, today we're talking about how you use modern fabrication techniques to manufacture things from the peak mechanical engineering periods of camera making. And I know that one of the things that you've talked about is that you can't get the same kind of precision. Can you discuss some of the limitations and advantages of 3D printing these cameras and camera parts?
Sure. So every process has its set of limitations. 3D printing allows me to make things cheaply, allows me to make the first one relatively quick, and it allows me to make shapes that are traditionally impossible with subtractive manufacturing, things like routing or milling. It does have its own set of limitations, like plastic is not as strong as metal. The 3D printers that I'm using do not have the same resolution as very precise watch milling machine, for example. I try and be kind of Bauhaus about working within the limitations of the material. So often I will have a camera with a set of gears or working movements, and I've got to figure out how to achieve precision results without precision parts. And so one of my favorite cameras is a Deerdorf 8x10. It's an old folding wooden camera. It's got a lot of, you know, stainless steel and brass cut parts that fit into wood. And the way they achieve precision movements is they cut very precise gears, and they polish them and they put them together very precisely. I can't print a gear that's that smooth or that small or that strong. But what I can do is build two gears and put the spindle or the axle of one gear on some sort of adjustment mechanism so that I can then, after the fact, tension the two gears together so that I can achieve like a smooth movement out of two imprecise pieces. Yeah, you could do something in metal smaller, but any material you use has its inherent pros and cons or advantages and disadvantages for what you're trying to do. And so, yeah, I tend to make big bulky cameras that are very strong and not as sleek as maybe a metal camera from the 80s.
But they have their own kind of gorgeous aesthetic, if you want to know the truth. You know, there's something about, like you say, if you're playing to the particular medium or the material and it's a strong design, then it will come out looking in some ways more interesting. You know, you talk about the sleek or highly polished look of the film cameras, you know, at their peak. But in a way, given modern phones, given the crap that we have in our cars, all the modern sleek tech, there's actually something really refreshing about, like you say, you know, you say it's big and bulky, but there's something kind of cool and different about that, I think, anyway.
I agree. I think good design always sort of takes advantage of the materials that you're using.
Treat it as your strength and not the weakness.
So I'm curious, earlier we were talking about if you were walked into a Nikon factory, how you would have all these different machines doing different things and creating different parts.
I would love to walk into a Nikon factory.
Well, do you use the same materials for all your parts that you print?
So I try really hard not to carry inventory of parts, and I try really hard not not to use things that are sort of off-the-shelf precursors that are complicated to cameras. So right now I'm using a lot of like lenses and shutters that are sourced from eBay. It's really hard for me to open a lens factory, although I'm working on it. But for the most part, if I can 3D print it, I will, unless there's a really good reason not to. So on my first camera design, I even 3D printed the screws and the nuts, right? Just to see if I could. Later on, you know, okay, I try now and...
You got over it.
Yeah. Well, so now I use exclusively M3 hex screws if I can get away with it. And so, you know, my cameras, you can assemble and disassemble entirely with one Allen key. I've actually designed all of the spring movements of the film counter and the door lock on the last camera that I made to take one Bic Pen spring cut in half. Just really trying to make it such that I don't have to source and carry inventory of parts. I made a light meter a while ago, and it used 15 different parts. Some were surface mount, some were through hole. A lot of them came from China. Like, it's hard keeping
the electronics you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And it's just sort of hard being stock in parts like that. I try as much as I can to make things out of, you know, one or two materials. Sometimes I laser cut things like dials. The laser cutter is really nice.
What I'm learning today as a camera is a black box that only lets light in a very controlled way. So can you engineer it to be dark inside?
Absolutely. Yeah. I can engineer boxes to be dark inside. That is my best engineering skill in many different ways, right? There's, you know, a lot of plastics will actually sort of glow in light. They're not totally opaque. And so there are thicknesses and colors of plastic. You'll notice a lot of my cameras have black bodies. That's for a reason, so I don't have to spray paint the inside so that they're totally light tight. But then there's also interfaces between those black body pieces and colored spring backs and focusing rings and lens locks and things like that. And whenever there's one of those interfaces, you have the ability to let in light. And so sometimes I will use foam and sometimes I will just use interlocking baffled pieces. So like on the door of this panoramic camera, there's no foam on the light seal. It just has, you know, a finger that goes all the way around into a track, and light can't, you know, make 7 180 degree turns to get through it. The homunculus does not use a foam seal. The panoramic does use a foam seal, and there's some reasons around use as to why. But yeah, there are a lot of ways to skin a cat. You don't have to use foam to seal things for light seals, for sure, but it helps sometimes.
Something I was thinking about when you were talking about using very few parts and using the parts you're not manufacturing yourself and using parts that aren't difficult to source, the irony is you're started on a lot of this because you can't get parts.
Yeah.
For old cameras.
For sure.
And it's almost like you're thinking about not dead-ending in your own process of doing this, but, you know, the idea that you'd be able to get 3-millimeter screws or 1/8-inch diameter screws is highly likely.
Yes.
It's not like a special thing. And I think it's really interesting how you seem to be making an effort to not fall into the trap that your beloved cameras fell into to begin with. With that in mind, the optics are not something you're going to make, presumably, unless you start grinding your own lenses. But you said you're sourcing most of those on eBay?
There's a couple of things there. It's not just not having inventory of lots of pieces, but it's not having inventory of lots of tools, right? And so if I can make something 99% on this one $200 tool that I happen to have 10 of, I don't have to have a workshop full of tools. Now, I'm a member of the Makerspace downtown, and we have some amazing tools, the laser cutter being my favorite. You know, I don't have one in my shop. I don't have the space for the ventilation. They're big and expensive and heavy. But yeah, designing for one tool is almost more important to me than designing for only one precursor, one input to the process. The other thing you were asking about is lenses. Lens manufacturing is hard, right? So I think there's actually some really interesting advancements in 3D printing technology around injection molding and resin printing that will start to allow us to make really interesting lenses. We have programs like ZMax. It's a CAD software, but for lens design. So, you know, they make, let's say, Eagle or KiCad for PCB design, and they make SolidWorks and Fusion 360 for mechanical design. So they make ZMax for optical design, right? And you can read old patents for optical designs of beautiful modern lenses that are well expired. But the problem is they all not only use curvature of lenses, but also variable indices of refraction, which is sort of, you could think of it as the optical density of glass, even though that's not exactly it, but it's how much one type of glass bends light. And so while you can know exactly how to build, you know, a double Gauss lens, which is like a really common lens in a lot of cameras, really beautiful lens, you can know sort of how it's working and what it's doing, but you might not know how to manufacture that, right? So if I could just, you know, snap my fingers and my glass making machine would make me any shape and any density that I want, cool. I don't have that yet. I think Formlabs and Stratasys are getting pretty darn close. I think some of the optical resins for the fiber optic industry or even the dental industry are like getting pretty darn close. And I think we're going to see a little bit of a revolution in there. But right now, to make glass, you know, you pour a bunch of metals and silica together and you mix them up and then you pour them out into the molds under incredibly controlled industrial conditions. And then you grind and polish
and grind and polish
on huge machines built specifically for that one lens curvature or, you know, a few. For me to build even one element, we're now talking like thousands of square feet just to make one thing, right? And so I don't think people at my scale, right, medium and small size makers are ever going to open a glass foundry and start making elements. However, maybe they will start making some resin lenses. Maybe they'll start grinding and polishing like polycarb lenses that are actually pretty decent for eyeglasses that are super available. It's almost like a natural occurring fiber in nature is polycarbonate eyeglasses. There's billions of them on the planet, and some of them are pretty high quality. But, you know, for now, I think you can still buy a lot of optical elements from China for not very much money. And there are certain lens designs that are not quite modern optics, but pretty close, pretty faithful optics that rely on symmetrical designs, which is interesting because you can buy singlets and doublets and sometimes triplets online, and you just buy two and reverse them and point them at each other, and then all of a sudden you start having symmetrical lens designs that correct for aberrations.
I get it. Okay. And so that's where you put the same lenses reverse of each other?
Yeah. If you were to flip the lens around, the side that's facing the film versus the side that's facing the subject, it wouldn't matter, right? And so you start getting asymmetrical lens designs, more modern computer calculated designs
right.
that have the manufacturing ability. But before calculus, people did not get very far at all. Once they had calculus, but before computers, they got a little bit farther, but not so crazy. Because of the nature of their reliance on symmetry, if you were to buy some wacky lens group, so long as you buy two of them, you can generally make, at least for large format, like a sort of reliable lens. It's something I'm working on right now. I think as I'm trying to put out like a self-developing back for 20 by 24, and I can build on the laser cutter some, you know, really big 20 by 24 cameras that are not super expensive. The one barrier for people using this at home, right, under a couple $100, maybe $1,000 even, is buying a lens, right?
Right.
Now you have to go find a process lens that would cover such a huge piece of film. Right. You know, I have one. It's an 8-pound piece of glass. It's they get expensive.
Yeah.
But I think I might. It's one of my many projects that I'm working on.
That's really cool. In fact, I actually want to leave this segment with the idea of repurposing old eyeglasses. I just love that idea because.
Okay, to be fair, though, I didn't really mean like a recycling old eyeglasses because they're very cheap and. Regrinding old eyeglasses would be more like
there's a lot of work, right?
Yeah. In fact, that's something like there's a lot of scavenged materials that I sort of disregard in my business because I need repeatability to be able to either make a lot of them or have a lot of people make them. You know, my friend Dennis the other day was, hey, do you want these old lenses? You could take the pieces out and make some new lenses. And I said, you know, I have old lenses I haven't taken apart too. The reason I don't want to do this is I can never buy another third zoom element from a Tamron 28-70 from 1986. You know, I can make three of them if I buy every stock on eBay, but it would be nice if I was like a little bit more recycly, but for now I use a lot of brand new things.
I hadn't even thought about, we still have all this stuff that is just floating around waiting for someone to find that new purpose for it. In fact, with you and your whole community trading the old stuff around, the old camera parts around on eBay, I still think is good because otherwise it's just going to go landfill-y. Anyway, I mean,
sure.
It's like you said, $1,000 lens from some decades ago probably can be had for pennies on the dollar now, I would presume.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been just a really interesting discussion. Thanks for being with us today, Ethan.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
For more about Ethan Moses and his work, visit cameradactyl.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music is courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.